Chug Points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Acton's Quality Roofing.
Let's go.
I think we all realize just how tough it is to clear the homeless camps from the freeway. You can't just kick people out. And a year into the new right-of-way initiative, we're starting to get an idea of just how difficult this is going to be. So, Chris, fill us in on the latest numbers.
As you know, sweeping camps, kicking people out of the way is one way of tackling the problem. But those people come back or they just move somewhere else. Doesn't really solve the root issue of where they're going to go. As you know, the state switched up its tactics last year, making sure that people had someplace to go before those camps were cleared. But how do you find places for people in the 2,100 homeless camps along WSDOT right away? Let me say that number again. 2,100 encampments statewide, and that's just on WSDOT property, and that's across the state. Everything from small roads, small highways, all the way to I-5, the stuff that we see every day up here. WSDOT's Andrea Fortune says the price for cleaning the garbage has skyrocketed.
We've seen a steady increase in costs associated with cleanup activities. In 2008, it was around $200,000, and in 2022, it was $2.8 million.
That's just for cleaning up, and the legislature has actually given WSDOT about $12 million this biennium for cleanup. That ends this summer, and then they're going to, the legislature's working on more right now in session. Colin DeForest is the homeless response manager for the Washington Department of Transportation. He says the state is focusing on the biggest camps first in King, Pierce, Snohomish, Thurston, and Spokane counties.
We want to identify a positive step for every one of these individuals to move forward. Whether or not those individuals take it on the first try, the third try, the fifth try, we're going to continue trying with these individuals. But our goal is to not just check a box. We want to identify positive opportunities and positive steps for these people to move forward.
In the first year of this initiative, the state has worked on 17 encampments, including rest areas. It has closed seven of them so far, including a very small but very risky camp that probably none of us had even known about, because it's under 520 at Portage Bay.
101 propane tanks removed underneath the freeway, right? So just, this is a great example of why it is so very important that we do this work, because we all know what happens, right? Fires, propane tanks, there's nothing good that's going to come of that.
And that was right under the freeway. This encampment was about as tall underneath as we are in the studio, so about 10 feet of space.
Wow.
And 101 propane tanks. And that's just one.
Wait, they're full? Or?
Yeah, well, a combination there. Thereof. And
wow.
So that's what we're talking about. In fact, yesterday we saw another huge encampment fire under the West Seattle Bridge in I-5 yesterday morning. And we all know exploding propane tanks near the freeway is not a good situation. Now, the 1,022 people the state has contacted in these 17 camps, 376 of them have accepted the housing that was offered. It's only 37%. But of those 376, 269 are still in housing. That's 72%. So a little bit of progress there. I mean, we are seeing some positive numbers out of this. It's just taking a very long time. Washington Department of Transportation Assistant Secretary Mike Gribner says people often accept or deny the housing help depending on what kind of housing it is. For instance, some don't want dormitory-style housing where they're stuck in the same rooms with people in cots, and many are really concerned about their stuff.
Some of the things that may be perceived as garbage may not be garbage to the residents. You know, there's always some consideration on what and how things are sorted and disposed of.
And part of this initiative does include securing belongings for a significant amount of time, which is also of great concern. And that also includes RVs. I mean, if they can find a place for people to get their RVs to someplace and then get them into something where they're not living in their RV, that's one of the things that they're looking at. Now to the dollars and cents of this thing, and I'm going to start digging in on this really, you know, over the next little bit. The governor put $40 million into this initiative, but the state as a whole has put in $143 million into this in 1 year, but that's only translating into 927 new beds by the end of this year. So that does seem like an awful lot of money for not a lot of bang for your buck. So I'm going to be digging into that. That's for another day. By the way, I know a lot of people are very concerned about the encampment at the north end of the Ship Canal Bridge. WSDOT's been working on this one for months now. They still don't know exactly how many people are living there. It's kind of a transient, a lot more in and out there. But they're actively working to clear it. But it's just that one's taking an awful lot of time. But some positive news here out of this, Dave. But again, the dollars and cents of it, I'm still trying to get to the bottom of.
$143 million for 927 new beds works out to $154,261 per bed.
Yeah, that's, and again, when the people were giving this discussion to the Washington State Department or Transportation Commission earlier this week, they said it's kind of hard. That number looks larger than it might be because there are all sorts of different pots involved. Like it might be from finding a shelter bed to buying a hotel to doing this. But you're right, that's an awful lot of money for one bed, and that's only for this year. So, and again, there's nothing that says they have to spend that $143 million this year. That's just what's been earmarked.
Yeah.
It's not like they've spent that and only gotten $927, but still.
Okay, because that,
that's a huge number.
You just build 927 houses.
Well, or small houses, yeah. And the people seem to like the small houses. And in fact, at one camp, the one that they cleared at Dearborn, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's I think they were close to 60 or 62 people that they contacted. Mm-hmm. 57 of them accepted the help and are still in housing. So there, it really kind of depends on the type of housing that people are willing to get into to get out of the situation that they're in. And as we talked about earlier in the session, Matt Markovich talked about, we discussed, you know, what permanent housing was, and there was like so all sorts of semantics involved in this, and people were not, you know, moving forward. So there's a lot that's going into this, a lot of different agencies, but there is some positive news out of this, and I think that's something we should highlight.
That's good. So how many people do they have on this team? Do you know?
Oh, well, on the Rights Away initiative? Yeah. I mean, well, that's the thing, because they have, I mean, this, we have the statewide issue that's involved Department of Transportation, Department of Commerce, Washington State Patrol, I mean, all of these agencies. But then what it comes down to is it's the local small advocate groups that they work with to find the local houses. So there's a bunch of people involved in this, plus the people that are out there every day trying to help, you know, understand where these people are in their lives, what they need to do. So it's a huge effort.
And when somebody turns down a cot, I mean, is that an alternative? I mean, it's not like you're going to be in the cot forever, right? I mean, you still have the possibility of being moved into a tiny home or something else.
Exactly. But the thing is that, again, the way the language is written in this, and that's where I think we got into some of the semantic issues on this, is you have to be significantly better than you are right now living next to the freeway. And to some people,
anything is better, isn't it?
To some people, yes. But to the people living in those camps, maybe not. But again, I drove up the express lanes yesterday. One of the largest tents right there on the west side of that particular homeless camp is about 8 feet from the traveling public support. Yeah. Only by a jersey barrier is the only separation. So, I mean, it's a situation that can be very difficult to crack. But I think we can all agree 101 propane tanks under the freeway is probably not a really good situation.
It is day 67 of the legislative session in Olympia. Republicans are accusing Democrats of being soft on crime. Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Matt Markovich to find out why they would say that. Matt.
Good morning, Dave. I'm glad you're keeping track on that date there. 67 days so far in a 105-day session. Yeah, they had a rally on the steps. A couple of Republican representatives had a rally on the steps of the Capitol yesterday. And I thought this was interesting because just a couple of days earlier, the Republican leadership, and again, the Republicans are in a minority. The Democrats have full control over everything, basically, in Olympia in terms of votes. That the Republican leadership said, hey, this is actually pretty good. We're actually having some congenial talks with Democrats. So then you have three Republicans coming on the steps saying, hey, no, the Democrats are soft on crime. Republican Representative Jim Walsh says Democrats are focused on the wrong group of people.
We're focusing too much on the ones who do wrong and not enough on the ones who've been done wrong to.
And Representative Jenny Graham from Spokane laid out the point of their rally.
Have solutions that are not making it to the committees for hearings or making it to the floor for your elected officials to be able to vote on. One of the bills is in a nutshell, says if you create a violent crime, you're not eligible for early release if you use a firearm.
And, you know, that talks about what happened with the pursuit bill. You know, mm-hmm. it wasn't going to get a hearing, and then finally it did, and it passed out of the Senate in a last 11th-hour deal. And basically that's the point of this rally, was they're putting pressure on the Democrats to put these bills to a vote so people can hear the debate, even bring it up in a committee. Representative Michelle Collier used this example.
I think it's such a slap in the face that there was one proposal that would have allowed prisoners to have minimum wage, and we've never fully funded the crime victims' compensation account. Seriously, that should be a higher priority than paying prisoners to work.
And just to clarify, in that previous cut, Republican Jenny Graham was saying that the Republicans were not being tough enough on gun crimes?
The Republicans not being tough enough on gun crimes?
No, the Republicans were saying
the Democrats are not being tough enough.
Yeah,
on,
right.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's what she was pointing out. Her bill there died. It didn't happen. If you have a use a firearm, there's that enhancement.
It seems strange because I thought the Democrats were, you know, big on punishing people who use guns.
You'd think on that particular bill, I don't know whether they even got a hearing. I'm not on that one. I just know that it's not alive anymore. But you're correct. I mean, the Law and Order Party, the Republicans are trying to make a point. I think, again, the point of all this was that they're putting pressure on the Democrats to let the public see them vote. Count the votes. Who's voting against crime? You know, tougher laws that would, you know, go against the criminals more so than protect the victims. They want to see a public showing of votes on this, and that was the point of the rally.
Okay, on security deposits for renters.
Yeah, I think this is what everybody can relate to if you've ever been a renter. What is wear and tear? Normal wear and tear, and how the security deposit works. I mean, here's Hunter. They're having a debate on what is the definition of normal wear and tear, and whether you can take kind of repairs like carpet cleaning and stuff out of a security deposit. Now, Hunter Herrera McFarland talks about her recent experience that many renters can relate to.
I deep cleaned my single family home, and I hired a carpet cleaner. I even fixed nail holes in my wall. I did everything correct. And despite this, my landlord told me that a cleaning crew had to spend 11 hours cleaning the unit after I vacated. And the invoice he sent me didn't have the name of the company on it. And when I requested the name, he told me he would not provide it to me. Okay, because it's not required by law to provide me verifiable documentation, and this piece of legislation would change that.
And that kind of summarizes what this whole thing's about. What can landlords do with that security deposit? And this bill would actually toughen things up. And basically, Sarah Nagy of the Columbia Legal Services lays out what the real problem is here.
Landlords can't deduct from the deposit for damages that constitute ordinary wear and tear, but that's not defined in statute currently. There's just no consistency in what one landlord sees as ordinary wear and what another landlord does. It's a crapshoot every time.
I mean, for example, a lawmaker asked a property manager who was testifying if it's really a situation, I know wear and tear when I see it.
We generally have it's real obvious damage or they've been there forever, and so there's no charges.
I think that might be a little bit of the heart of what we're getting to today.
Yeah, so they're just trying to define what is wear and tear. So this new bill would basically define it as this, such as wear that does not include deterioration, and that's a big word here, resulting from negligence, carelessness, an accident, abuse of the premises, fixtures, equipment, appliances, or furnishing. Deterioration from negligence. That's a hard thing to define, but that's how the bill is going to define what wear and tear is. And they're not going to use wear and tear anymore. They're going to use the term ordinary use of the premises.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no real requirement right now to have landlords itemize repairs, but this bill would put that in there. Again, Sarah explains what's happening now.
The full and specific basis for withholding the deposit doesn't require documentation of actual costs, so it's very easy for bad actors to exaggerate the cost of supplies or labor. They can simply put down a price on a piece of paper and present it to the tenant as an invoice with nothing behind it, and that's the number there is.
And the property managers that testified in the hearing like parts of the bill. They like the idea that there's some definition, but what they didn't really like was that the bill requires a 30-day requirement for the landlord to present the tenant who's moving out an itemized list of repairs. And given the current climate of trying to get things fixed, they said that's impossible to do these days within 30 days. Now, a landlord can still charge for cleaning fees, but it can't be taken out of the security deposit and it must be stated up front. And the landlord is also given the opportunity to sue for the cost of repairs for up to 3 years after the tenant moves out. Now, again, Sarah explains why this is so important for the renter, because if they can't pay the landlord, that rental debt follows them a long way.
That keeps tenants out of future tenancies. The fact of that debt is reason enough to deny someone's housing application, regardless of whether they're working on disputing it, regardless of the circumstances of it, regardless if there's any proof at all that these damages ever really existed, that can still keep someone out of housing.
I heard the story from the tenant who said that she did all the, you know, all the due diligence, covered up the nail holes and everything. Were there any stories from landlords about the kind of damage that they sometimes
oh, yeah, see? They had, yeah. And I mean, they talked about $10,000 to $20,000 repair bills. One person talked about a $70,000 repair bill.
That doesn't sound like normal wear and tear.
No, that's not wear and tear. But again, if the tenant has been there, living there for 30 years, and they walk in and say, wow, that couch is really done. You know, they charge them for the couch. And the lawyers were talking about how they're, some landlords basically charge a remodel if they've been there for a long time.
I see.
So they're trying to define what everything is there. And again, the landlords like parts of it. Again, if when you have both sides liking parts of it and other parts that are not, you know, not so cool, that's kind of a clue that this bill won't go through all the way to the finish line this particular session because there's too many questions.
Cairo News Radio's Matt Markovich. Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome, Dave.
7:48 and now from the G. and Ursula Show, which starts at 9. Here he is, G. Scott. So explain to us this this Aaron Rodgers story.
Well, Aaron Rodgers came back from his little hiatus because he likes to be Aaron Rodgers. And basically he got on Pat McAfee's show to let the world know that it wasn't him that's holding things up. He said it's the Green Bay Packers, you know, because everybody's is expected.
So there's some question whether he's going to be the quarterback still?
No, he's not going to be the quarterback. There's no question. He's not going to be the quarterback for the Green Bay Packers. But the speculation was that he was going to be the next quarterback for the New York Jets and that that trade was going to happen. A lot of people thought that that was going to happen because the, you know, free agency time was going to be happening in March. And then most teams usually have a certain amount of time, usually in March, to figure out what they're going to do with their court, with their trades or their options. Well, come to find out that the Green Bay Packers have until September 1st to whether or not they want to pick up the $58 million for Aaron Rodgers. So, here's let me explain it. Aaron Rodgers, the Green Bay Packers are basically saying, yeah, we're going to trade you when we get around to it. We're going to just slow this process up a little bit. We can't trade you now and let you go to the Jets and get a full preseason win with you guys and off season and kumbaya and
this
getting together to know your team. Maybe we just wait until, because we already know our quarterback. The Green Bay Packers have Jordan Love. Maybe we just wait until August, maybe, to trade you on over.
Well, Green Bay believes that Rodgers is worth at least a couple of first-round picks like the Rams got for Stafford.
Yeah, but the Green Bay Packers are now saying that they're not asking for two first-round picks. Whatever the case might be, I agree. I think they do believe that, and they actually, people speculated that they believe that. I believe that they want two first-round picks. Either way, whatever they want, Kate, they gonna take their sweet time. Have you ever been in a situation where you have the leverage, Dave?
Yes.
And you take your sweet time? Like if you owe somebody some money and you go to pay them back, instead of giving them the $500 and $100 bills, you decide to pay them in pennies. That's the pettiness that the Green Bay Packers are showing right
this
now.
This is payback for Rodgers showing his dissatisfaction with the team these past couple of seasons. But the Jets don't have that kind of time. They're desperate. I mean, they can't start Zach Wilson. That is not an option.
So are you guys saying that it's not a good idea to go grocery shopping when you're hungry? Yeah, it's not good. You can start getting desperate. Now, as far as for the Jets, here's my message to the Jets. What are you doing? What are you doing? Do you really want this Aaron Rodgers? Do you really want this problem? Have we not seen an example of sometimes when a highly expected, really good quarterback is coming to your organization to change everything, and maybe it doesn't go right? I ain't want to gossip. You ain't heard it from me. But for some reason, I can't think of another situation when a quarterback did not work out like the organization thought it would.
Tom Brady?
Tom Brady won.
That worked out pretty well.
Now, Dave, before you answer, don't get petty now. I don't know if you know what I'm thinking in my mind, but I can't think right now.
I think I know what you're thinking in your mind, but I know nothing about sports, so I'm not even going to take the risk.
The Jets have a young team. They have a very talented team, and some people say Super Bowl caliber. So with Rodgers at the helm instead of Zach Wilson, who, remember, they benched last season. Mm-hmm. I don't know. If Breece Hall comes back from his injury better, who knows? I mean, Rodgers still got it. He can throw a ball.
You ever have those listening right now, you ever had that talented person at your job that's really, really talented, but they're a problem?
I have you, G.
Oh, thanks. That's pretty good, Kate.
I have another question for you. The Edwin Diaz story.
Hey, man.
He injures himself during the celebration. Now, my question, that's happened before. It's a terrible thing. But aren't baseball contracts are guaranteed, right?
Yeah.
So does he get the full $100 million even if he can't?
You know it, baby.
Wow.
You know it. And for those wanting to know, how much is that contract? Well, let me explain. First of all, the New York Mets made Edwin Diaz the highest paid reliever ever in the game. So in November-ish of last year, they blessed him. You know, if you guys, Edwin Diaz, Mariner fans, you guys remember him. Edwin Diaz now with the Mets, they gave him a $102 million contract, right? Yeah. And so he's going to basically he has a $17 million base. He'll get $27 million for the year. He'll kind of, get right, rehabilitate. And it's really unfortunate what happened. Now, there are people laughing about the celebration, about, him hurting himself celebrating. I ain't laughing. Because I'm not laughing because recently I was during the Seahawks pregame. I was doing my pregame show called The End Zone. I was doing some celebrating, and I hurt my knee a little bit celebrating.
During a radio show?
Well, I'm talking to the fans and all that, and I'm standing up, and I got excited, and it hurt my knee.
Gee, Scott, 9 o'clock. Your contract's guaranteed, though, so don't worry. You're fine.
Yeah.
A high school football coach who won a U.S. Supreme Court case allowing him to pray at games confirms he will be coaching at Bremerton High School this year. Cairo News Radio's Heather Bosch joins us live.
Assistant coach Joe Kennedy tells me he is ready to take the field.
I am fully on the staff now, and I'm just waiting for the head coach to tell me what day I need to report for spring ball or this fall or whatever he has planned.
The Bremerton School District says the process to reinstate Kennedy began well ahead of yesterday's court-ordered deadline. And tonight, the school board is expected to approve a settlement of more than $1,700,000 for Kennedy's attorney's fees. As for the coach,
I'm pretty nervous, actually.
He hasn't coached at Bremerton High since 2015, after the district asked him to stop praying on the 50-yard line after games. Last year, the Supreme Court ruled in Kennedy's favor, and now?
I don't feel like I missed a step as far as training young men to be better young men and getting the most out of them. Just all the unknowns of stepping back where you're in the public's eye and just hoping everything will fade really quickly and everybody can just move on to what's going on with the football season.
But he admitted to me that may be tough after years in the public eye, and if this becomes a distraction for the team.
I'm going to do what's best for the school and for my football team. So if it's me having to step aside because I'm getting in the way, then so be it.
Even so, he says the 8-year battle deal was worth it.
Seriously, if one high school football coach can actually stand up and change a nation, imagine what everybody could do if we actually just talked and stood up for our rights. I think the world would be a lot better place right now.
So you were standing up by taking a knee.
Yeah, good way of putting it.
Dave?
So is he going to, he'll do his post-game prayer alone on the field by himself? Is that what he plans to do?
We don't know. He's going to definitely take his prayer. Whether or not other young people will join him, we have yet to see.
And what caused the problems, as I recall, was that it wasn't just members of the team. Pretty soon, everybody was coming out of the stands.
Yes, it became a large ordeal, and that's when there were concerns raised that could players feel like they're being coerced to join in or not. And then, of course, it went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the majority found that the prayer was a personal matter, and they decided in Coach Kennedy's favor in a 6-3 vote.
Did Kennedy say if this is a one-season return or how long he will be with the team?
Great question. I pressed him on that, and he said he doesn't know. It depends on, as he said there, if he becomes a distraction again, he may back off. We also know that he has a book deal, and he has some speaking engagements, which also might be a factor. I asked him again and again, and he said, well, you know, I'm praying about it with my family, and we'll just have to see how this year goes.
Heather Bosch. Thank you, Heather. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Alexandra Robbins has written a series of category books about nurses, overachievers, sororities, geeks, tombs. And now you take on teachers in a book called The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. So you spent a year following three teachers. How did you do that?
Well, it hasn't been easy to get inside schools in the last 3 years during the pandemic. So it was a lot of talking on the phone, a lot of emails, a lot of texting, a lot of closely following their stories. I followed three wonderful teachers: Penny, a math teacher in the South; Miguel, a special ed teacher out West; and Rebecca, an elementary school teacher on the East Coast. So readers could really get immersed in their behind-the-scenes stories and secrets and understand teachers' points of view. I also interviewed hundreds of teachers across the country, so the public can understand what is really going on in schools.
Maybe you can offer some perspective then. We just had a report out of Washington State that turnover in the teaching profession is at a 37-year high, about 1,000 more teachers leaving the profession year over year. So what is the cause of that turnover nationally?
I think there's sort of a three-pronged attack going on. First of all, they aren't paid enough. The teacher pay gap has hit a historical high, and what that means is that right now teachers are paid 24% less than professionals in other industries with similar education and experience. That's one. Number two, districts aren't supplying teachers with what they actually need to get their jobs done. There's not enough support staff, not enough resources. There should be paraeducators, counselors, aides. There should be a nurse in every school, and districts aren't supplying those, which puts more on teachers' backs. And then three, the amount of disrespect and second guessing of teachers currently in the nation is horrific, frankly. So it's really no wonder that teachers are fleeing the profession.
That last point is one that I did want to ask you. Where did that breakdown between the parent-teacher relationships start? It used to be that they were working in tandem, and now it seems that parents are now going, what did your teacher say to you? Or what is this homework they're sending? Like, they're battling teachers.
Yeah, there's a teacher blaming educational narrative that's off the wall. And I talk to a lot of teachers about that, and they think it has a lot to do with the instant gratification of online access, cell phones, seeing your kids' grades in real time pop up as soon as the teacher inputs them into the system. There's kind of this immediacy, and there's this feeling that you have access to your kids' teachers at all times. Now, it's not a majority of parents who are this way, but the ones that are really making it difficult to be a teacher right now.
Now, are we talking public schools here, or did you visit some private schools or charter schools too?
I talked to teachers at all kinds of schools.
Is there a difference then? Because I noticed that the charter schools I've gone to, and these are public charter schools in Washington State, there seems to be a little more harmony, I guess I'd say, between the teachers, the parents, and the students, frankly, than there are in public schools.
I think that's a pretty broad generalization. Some charter schools, you'll certainly find excellent relationships. However, some charter schools, maybe in other areas, sort of shove students aside who they don't want to keep in the schools. Public schools call these charter school refugees. For example, students who are difficult or students who have special needs, the charter schools will kind of shunt them aside until they disenroll from the school. So charter schools sometimes have get to pick and choose which students they keep.
Based on all of your knowledge and experience, who exactly is failing the U.S. educational system?
Government politicians and district officials. They're not giving teachers what they need to properly be able to educate students.
Where's the money? I mean, they collect the taxes. Where's the money going?
That's what I'd like to know. They have the money. They're just, I think that there's this sense that, well, teachers have been doing this much for so long and that they're not going to turn their backs on students, which is true. Teachers love their students. Yeah. They would do anything for the students. The thing that teachers over and over told me again is that the reason they're leaving is because of the adults.
Yeah, you said there's not a teacher shortage. It's just that the job is actually, in many cases, affecting their health.
There's not a teacher shortage. There are plenty of potential qualified and aspiring educators. They exist in this country, and they are wonderful. There's not a teacher shortage. There is a shortage of jobs that adequately treat and compensate skilled professionals such that they would want to be teachers in the first place.
You have said that because of what you discovered in writing this book, that you're going to lay off writing books for a while and basically go to bat for teachers?
Yes, because, you know, the point of this book, I wanted it to be a book that sways the national dialogue in favor of teachers. I want to get into the national consciousness that those of us who have been quiet, and it's the majority of people, are in favor of educators, do support teachers with all their hearts, but they're just not speaking up, which has left this pocket for sort of an unhinged fringe to speak out negatively against teachers. So I want this book to change that, to let teachers know that people will fight for them, that we're fighting for them now. I wanted people to have a gift they can give teachers to show them their support and appreciation, especially during one of the hardest months of one of the most difficult years to be a teacher. March is such a hard month for teachers because it is a long month with no breaks, and some teachers even call it Death March.
Oh my.
Is there any place that's doing it right, either a school system or another country, where teachers are respected and they're able to educate all students to a level of competence that that makes parents happy?
Sure. Well, that's the point. Makes parents happy. So it turns out that at least 80% of parents are happy with their own schools, their own children's teachers. The negative voices that we hear are actually more often people who do not even have school-age children. Those are the people who have started driving these ridiculous political movements. They're people in the community who don't actually have kids in schools. But if you ask most parents across the country, they are happy with their local schools.
And I think there's a difference, too, between being happy with the person educating your child or perhaps the school they go to, and happy and satisfied with the way the school system is being run. Because in my experience, having school-age children, we've got PSOs and PTAs raising tens of thousands of dollars to supplement what the government should be providing, which is art lessons, music lessons, enriching science experiments and experiences. And to me, that's a little off. You're collecting tax dollars and you have parents of these students fundraising literally tens of thousands of dollars to supplement their education. That seems off.
Yes, I agree with you 100%. And then think of all those schools that don't have active PTAs who can get that kind of support.
Alexandra Robbins is author of The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. Alexandra, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.